This week on the Back Table Podcast.
The question of how aggressive surgically do you need to be is very up in the air right now. I can speak from experience when I say I've not regretted not being more surgically aggressive. In the majority of patients that I have treated, we've done limited debridement just to get the diagnosis and then really relied on the better antifungals that we have now. In a very prolonged course of treatment, I would say if you're faced with one of these cases, don't swing for the fences necessarily. And I think that that's something that we as a field need to really revisit is the necessity of aggressive surgical treatment in these patients with the new age of antifungals.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back Table ENT Podcast, where we discuss all things ENT. We bring you the best and brightest in our field with the hope that you can take something from our show to your practice. My name is Gopi Shah. I'm one of your hosts today. I'm a pediatric ENT, and I'm here, one of my favorite person to host these podcasts with, Dr. Ashley Agan. How are you, Ash?
Hey, Gopi. I'm so good. Excited to be here with you today and with our returning guests. We have the privilege of getting to check back in with Dr. Ashley Halderman today. If you guys missed her on episode 30, go back and check it out. She's back today. We're going to talk about chronic invasive fungal sinusitis. But first, let me give her a quick intro for those of you who don't know Ashley. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Otolaryngology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. After receiving her medical degree from Boston University, she completed her residency in otolaryngology at the Cleveland Clinic. She did her fellowship in rhinology and skull-based surgery at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She's the current president of the Texas Association of Otolaryngology. Welcome to the show, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's so good to see you both.
It's so great to see you. Tell us a little bit about the Texas Association of Otolaryngology. Congratulations on being the president of that, by the way.
Thank you. It's a really great group of people. Obviously, it's comprised of otolaryngologists practicing in Texas.
Yeehaw.
Yeah,
it's a big state. There's a lot of ENTs, a lot of academic centers.
Yeah. And so it's just sort of a really great way for me being involved in it. It's been an incredible way to meet other otolaryngologists from across the state and kind of become a resource for them. Working at an academic center, you have education at heart. And so that doesn't include just our residents and patients, being a source for other individuals taking care of patients in our state. We just recently opened up membership to nurse practitioners and physicians assistants, which we're really excited about. And we're really working to provide a lot of educational content. We're doing, I think in March, a webinar on postnasal drip.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's really relevant, actually.
It is. And the problem is no one wants to talk about it. So we're trying to cover some of those high yield topics that you're not going to hear people talk about. So postnasal drip will be coming up, I think, in March.
Very nice.
And we've also gotten into lobbying and legislation. And we had our first legislative win, which was to include CMV in universal screening for babies who do not pass their hearing test.
Good job.
Yeah. So we were really proud of that, thinking it was a positive win. So it's been really cool to be involved in the different kind of proxy areas that really impact the practice of medicine.
That's awesome, Ashley. Kudos. Before we get started, can you just kind of tell our audience a little bit about yourself and about your practice?
I've been practicing in Texas since 2016, and I am a subspecialist. So all I do is rhinology and skull-based surgery. And my practice is about 50-50. I have a pretty high volume of skull-based surgery. And until recently, I was covering Parkland. And Parkland is our county hospital, and we serve all patients, whether or not they can pay. And because of this unique sort of opportunity, we see very advanced pathology. And I think that's permitted me the opportunity to get a very well-rounded experience in my time thus far and to see some kind of things that are real head scratchers and having to really think outside the box. And the number of times that I said, I've never seen this before, my first few years here, it was very uncomfortable and unnerving. I've come to find that that's just sort of part of the normal process, but I think we get a little bit more of it at Parkland than than most places. So living in Texas, fungal sinusitis is kind of endemic. And it's interesting, actually, I never really thought about this until I was here and thinking about AFS being present in so many patients, but their incidence of acute invasive fungal sinusitis is actually higher in Texas. So if you look at some national database studies, you see the highest rates are in the South. And I think that's just because, again, it's endemic, it's everywhere. And my fellow last year was from the Northeast and she trained in New York City. And she was like, you guys have way more cases than we ever did. And, you know, I think there's really something to that. So
yeah,
fungus is among us.
For sure. For sure. As we kind of dive into this, do you think it would be helpful to kind of just lay out the different types of fungal sinusitis and then we can kind of go deep into the chronic invasive?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that I kind of categorize fungal sinusitis is there's two main categories. There's non-invasive and invasive. And so in the non-invasive forms, you're going to have your fungal ball and allergic fungal sinusitis. And essentially, in a fungal ball, it's going to include usually one sinus. We're not certain kind of how or why it happens. One thing that seems to increase the risk is prior endodontal work. And that might be changing because I believe that they're no longer using the zinc as part of the amalgamam. So, and that was the thing that kind of allowed this permissive environment, what was theorized. And that is something that you see sort of increasing as people age, the incidence increases of fungal balls. And there's not really any kind of immune response to the fungus. In allergic fungal sinusitis, obviously that is allergy based, or so we think. There is an IgE sensitivity to fungus in these patients, which is helping to kind of propagate and allow that disease to form. But there's not, otherwise, you know, the immune system isn't really combating it or ignoring it, I guess. So then the invasive forms can be subcategorized into acute and chronic. And acute is the one that we all fear. It is very high mortality between, I think the reports range anywhere from 20 to 80%. And I think the biggest series maybe landed at 50% mortality rate. And you're only going to see that in patients with fairly significant immune compromise. So either somebody with a hematologic malignancy who is on chemotherapy, who's had organ transplant, or is in diabetic ketoacidosis. And again, the diabetic ketoacidosis just sort of allows this permissive environment. The acidity is perfect for different fungus to kind of grow and invade. And there's immune issues within that state as well. And so it just gets a foothold and goes nuts. And then the chronic forms, there's both chronic invasive fungal sinusitis, which is what we're going to kind of talk about today and is pretty uncommon. And then you also have your chronic granulomatous invasive fungal sinusitis. So the differences between those two is that with chronic invasive, you're going to see some level of immune deficiency. It's usually not as profound as acute invasive, but it could be, you know, somebody's on high dose steroids for a while, or they have diabetes. I think most of the people that I've ever seen that have it have diabetes. And it, again, very rare, but the mortality rate is real. And it can be at a year, one paper said about 48% survival. So it's landing there at about that 50%, like acute invasive. And then chronic granulomatous tends to be in immunocompetent patients. There's not really any evidence of any degree of immunocompromise. And I kind of am suspicious that this might be on a spectrum. We at UT Southwestern had 5 cases of allergic fungal sinusitis that converted to chronic granulomatous. And actually, when they've gone back and looked at pathology for allergic fungal sinusitis cases in a study, a couple studies I think have been done, around 21% of AFS patients show some granulomatous sort of inflammation. And all of our patients, they were all young Black men. And those are typically the patients who tend to see the most significant or severe disease when it comes to allergic fungal sinusitis. So I kind of wonder, you know, is there something there? But it can also happen in isolation not associated with allergic fungal sinusitis, but it tends to be much more favorable. You know, I think mortality is pretty low. It's highly treatable.
So just to recap, the invasive, they're all angioinvasive. So when we talk about obviously acute IFS, we know it's invasive. We see, you know, always ask, is there angioinvasion on path? Chronic invasive, it makes sense. It's angioinvasive on path. They're slightly immunodeficient, we said, but also chronic granulomatous fungal sinusitis is also invasive as well.
I do not believe it's angioinvasive.
It's not angioinvasive.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
I don't think so. It's a great question, but I think that gets to the heart of why maybe it's less severe and less deadly. There can be orbital and intracranial extension of that. So perhaps at some level, but I'm not 100% sure.
And just to clarify, the thought is that the AFS is a spectrum and there may be a small percentage of AFS that turns into chronic granulomatous fungal sinusitis.
Possibly, yeah. And that's important to kind of pick up on because typically with allergic fungal sinusitis, antifungal therapy is not part of the treatment paradigm. However, with chronic granulomatous, then you do need to have these folks on oral antifungals for a fairly extended period of time to kind of fully clear up the disease. And we don't really understand that. Is it everybody if it just gets too far advanced? Is it only certain people with certain characteristics that develop it? My guess is that it's, you know, you have to have the right person, right place, right time for it to convert or to be present. But it's just something to kind of, I think, keep an eye out for, especially if you run into a really severe case of AFS that's particularly recalcitrant.
Yeah. And that's kind of what sparked this conversation, Ashley. Like several months ago, I was on call and there was a patient that came in that looked like one of these kind of really impressive AFS cases. And then you and I started looking at it together and you said, you know what, this could actually be chronic invasive. And then I was like, well, you need to come on the show and talk to me about this. Teach me more about this because that wasn't on my radar. So I guess we can kind of start at presentation and just what does the typical patient look like that we need to be kind of thinking about this diagnosis?
So it's always kind of weird, for lack of a better term. Generally, the classic patient tends to be kind of older. Most of the time they have diabetes and it's maybe not super well controlled, but it's also not like DKA area. And they're going to have symptoms for a very long period of time and they can be pretty non-specific symptoms. The first case I treated or diagnosed chronic invasive fungal sinusitis on was a woman in her 50s and she'd had a year of pretty severe left-sided facial pain. And she had been treated for sinusitis. She had been treated with gabapentin, all these kind of nerve. They thought she had some type of neuralgia and nothing was really touching it. And the pain was really severe throughout the whole like trigeminal distribution. So yeah, she went down the whole trigeminal neuralgia pathway. Then she went blind. And when she presented, there was pretty impressive destruction of the orbital apex and sort of the sphenoorbital area. And going back and hearing her story, it had been there this whole time for a year. And they just kind of missed what was causing it. And that being said, there was bony destruction. It was pretty impressive. You could see some sort of soft tissue changes as well in the orbital apex area. And so I took her to the operating room and took tons of biopsies in the sphenoid area and kind of along the lamina and whatnot. Nothing. They couldn't find anything. And I thought, this has got to be a cancer or something. So there's got to be something there. And I think the next time I took her back, I actually went into her orbital apex and was getting tissue samples because that seemed to be the hot spot. I tried to avoid it before because obviously you don't want to like take out a person's optic nerve. And I was still like very kind of cautious. And they saw some fungal elements on the frozen, which then they didn't see on the final pathology. But we had enough to go off of. And she started on the antifungal therapy and her pain got way better. So when you go into these cases, it's not necrotic. it's not looking, you know, it's not necessarily kind of slapping you in the face. It's like, this is blatantly abnormal. The tissue looked a little bit weird. It was maybe a little bit kind of pale and thickened, if you will. But again, it wasn't necrotic. So we got her on antifungals, and it was, I sent the tissue for culture. Nothing grew out. And that's a common theme in these cases, I find, is that sometimes it is kind of hard to achieve a true diagnosis and get tissue to send for culture and to get it to grow out. But we had to go just based off of a high level of suspicion. We hadn't found any cancer there. It had been going on for so long. She was diabetic. Her hemoglobin A1C wasn't awesome. And she started getting better once we started treating her with the antifungals. So, and I think here it was really sad too, because, you know, it had gone so long. She did really well on her antifungals, and then she just kind of stopped taking them and disappeared for a little while. And she came back with new facial pain and new headache again on that left side. And that was very worrisome to me. It was already involving her trigeminal nerve and her orbital apex. So I already had a high level of concern that it had gone intracranial. I think by definition it had. And I got imaging at that time, and it had gone wild intracranially. And she actually had sort of osteomyelitis type changes to the sphenoid wing. And she ended up going with neurosurgery to get kind of cleaned up, get cultures. And we were able to get a positive culture at that time. And so she's just going to be on lifelong antifungals, but she's still alive.
Wow. In terms of your initial scope, Ash, what did you see when she first came to your clinic, when you did endoscopy, or Ashley Agan, the patient that came to you guys on call? What are their scope care findings? Like, do you see polyps? You said you don't see that necrotic dead tissue. Are there any tip-offs?
No, for me, it was purely symptoms and imaging. And again, it was kind of limited to the sphenoid and the orbital apex. So with a scope exam, you're not going to be able to see that area. You might be able to see the sphenoethmoid recess. I had another case recently that I was highly suspicious of chronic invasive, and there was purulent. So, you know, we were kind of taking cultures, but sending, and again, the purulence was kind of the only thing. And the tissue just looked a little bit pale and thickened and inflamed a little bit, I guess, but not necrotic. So, and that other case, Ashley, I guess I'm remembering her as sort of a mix between like acute that transitioned to kind of more of a chronic. Is that the same case?
I'm thinking of a young man that where I was thinking AFS, like allergic fungal. And so maybe we can talk about that as a separate, because that maybe is the possible conversion to chronic granulomatous invasive fungal, right?
Or even to chronic invasive.
Oh, okay.
So there have been some reports, and this makes sense, that in individuals who have allergic fungal or have a fungal ball, if they then experience some immunocompromise, that can convert into any. It can convert into acute. It can convert into chronic, depending on the level of immunosuppression. So probably in that setting, I think that individual have diabetes.
Mm-mm. No, it's like a young, okay, healthy, like 20-something year old kid.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. And so that might have been then chronic granulomatous.
I think there was something on the MRI that suggested that maybe it was a little bit different than the classic AFS. They had been kind of worked up CT and MRI at like an outside hospital. So they were coming in with all of that imaging.
Yeah. And it's interesting, the chronic granulomatous, it's going to appear kind of as a mass on imaging, whereas chronic invasive is going to appear as more infiltrative.
So like for your lady that had been sent to for like a workup for trigeminal neuralgia and everything, does that mean that her scans were clean, that there was no sinus disease that could be attributed to her symptoms, and people were like, hey, it looks clean, like let's send you to neurology? Or like,
I think she had some mild findings in her sinuses, pretty mild, like maybe just a little bit of mucosal thickening. And they did treat her for sinusitis, but it didn't make any difference. So I think that they kind of abandoned that and went for the pain was the predominant symptom. And she wasn't really having any sinonasal symptoms. And so I don't certainly blame anybody for that kind of thought process. And I think that the destruction of the orbital apex was kind of a later finding. I think that if that had been present immediately, alarm bells would have been ringing.
And since it had been a year, maybe she got that CT early on. Maybe there wasn't much there. And then it was MRI after MRI, and you don't get great bony characteristics.
Yeah, predominantly intracranial MRIs, you know, MRIs of the trigeminal. And I can't tell you how many times like you get one of those scans and there's no comments at all on the sinuses. So
So in patients who are presenting with predominantly like a pain, facial pain complaint, I feel like it would be very easy to miss this because it's so rare that most of us probably aren't thinking of chronic invasive because patients coming in with sinus headache and facial pain are pretty common. And the percentage of them that are experiencing a chronic invasive fungal sinusitis is probably very, very low. But also,
yes,
you don't want to miss this. So any other questions that kind of help tip you off? Or is it just the kind of chronic worsening nature of it? Like, kind of walk me through your clinic visit to where we can kind of make sure that we're catching these. Because these are mostly presenting in the clinic, not in the hospital, like an acute, right?
No, the ones that I've seen have all presented in the hospital, actually. And it's because, unfortunately, by the time they kind of get to us is they've gone blind or they've developed some type of orbital symptoms, if you will, or the imaging is very concerning for like a mass or a tumor. And so that's how they typically end up with us. And if you were just going off of facial pain alone, it is difficult. And you're right. The majority of those patients are not going to have chronic invasive fungal sinusitis. And again, if they don't have any possible immune deficiency, like they're not diabetic, they haven't been on steroids, all of these things, then that further sort of is like, probably not the case. There's been a few studies that have looked at sort of the findings, and I think you just have to kind of have a suspicious eye. And I wish that I could give you something more solid, but I guess I would have to say that just based off of my experience and my learning through practice, I've been better at spotting these things. It's taken some trial and error a little bit. So I wasn't perfect and I still am not. But when I'm looking at a case, again, usually a lot of the groundwork has been done and there's some pretty abnormal findings on the imaging, like soft tissue involvement of the orbit, destruction of the bone, involvement of the pterygopalatine fossa structures, and they're presenting with symptoms like pain or paresthesias, which absolutely should be very, very concerning for anybody. Paresthesias needs further investigation for sure. And it's just sort of that clinical picture of all of those things. I think in isolation, pain without findings in those areas, without sort of anything concerning, I don't think you need to be too worried.
Do patients have like other sinonasal symptoms? You know, runny nose, nasal congestion, purulent drainage?
Not predominantly. You know, you can't ever say never, but they tend to really present with headache, facial pain, and orbital symptoms, and sort of less so. I think chronic granulomatous may present more with nasal symptoms, but chronic invasive, not so much. I think everyone that I've ever diagnosed with chronic invasive has had either the facial pain, facial numbness, and orbital involvement, so diplopia or vision loss or what, Apex syndrome, things like that.
And just to review the imaging findings, so on CT, we said there's going to be more destructive lesions. Are you going to see erosion? You're not going to see expansile changes? Like, walk me through some of the key CT and MRI findings. I know on MRI, you mentioned soft tissue changes, but just to kind of have that organized.
So, and I was doing a little bit of reading last night, just to kind of make sure. And the majority of the patients are going to show some findings, like I said, around the sphenoorbital and skull base region. So bony destruction and abnormalities, both in the kind of like the soft tissue of the pterygopalatine fissure, orbital kind of area, orbital apex is what I've seen. But also there was a case that was involving the maxillary sinus, and this person has sort of abnormal findings along the lateral aspect of the maxillary sinus bone and like some soft tissue density there as well. And that kind of heightened my level of concern, especially because he was having like these sinus findings. They weren't really severe, but he was having paresthesias. So that just kind of, I was like, this is weird. We need to biopsy this. I think it might be chronic invasive. As far as the MRIs, you're going to see some abnormal sort of signaling. I believe that most of the time it does kind of enhance. But if it's pretty far gone, there might actually be a decrease in sort of uptake and like abnormal enhancement going the other direction. It's not enhancing like you would expect it to necessarily if the tissue has been kind of compromised. And then for invasive, chronic invasive, it is enhancing and it can be pretty impressive. I know that from a case that we had in residency.
So chronic invasive is enhancing.
It can be, yes. But I think it depends on like how far into the course you are, right?
Okay.
Because if we lose some of the tissue viability and the tissue is just in general not healthy, I think you're going to have a loss mm-hmm. of that. Yeah. But I believe typically it is enhancing on T1. Yeah.
For most of these patients, it would be appropriate to start with a CT. And then if you're seeing bony erosion, or if you're seeing something that looks like a tumor, but you know, you're not sure, then you get an MRI.
And I think you also get an MRI based off of the symptoms that they're having. If they're having pain and numbness, then I want to know what their cranial nerves look like.
So for the AFS patient, the allergic fungal patient, that we're concerned could have some areas that have converted to a more chronic invasive, is there something on the CT or the MRI that tips you off to that? Because for those patients, correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume some of their CT is going to look like the classic AFS with like expansile, like that expansive sinus looking picture. Can you comment on that part?
Yeah. So expansile, but not invasive, right? And not infiltrative. So anybody who has AFS, but is again presenting with facial numbness or facial pain, that's sort of really acute, or, you know, it just doesn't seem to, because most people with AFS don't present with facial pain. It's been a long ongoing process. And so that's just not usually part of it. They've sort of adapted, you know, as everything's expanding and kind of building up. Pain is not usually something that's reported, but AFS kind of obeys boundaries to an extent. It's going to kind of be this pushing border that's sort of smooth and is not actually invading the tissue. And so in somebody who has maybe some atypical symptoms, who has AFS, you get imaging, then I'm going to look at invasion. Is this no longer a pushing border and it's starting to infiltrate into the orbit or the pterygobehalentine fossa or intracranially? And you're going to look, do they have a V2 numbness? I'm going to look along the course of V2 and see, is it enhancing? Does that appear abnormal? Do I need to be concerned that something is happening along this nerve? So it's these subtle, very subtle things, but that's what you would be looking for.
So they could have some areas of imaging that look like classic AFS and then some areas where it's like, oh, maybe this is actually starting to invade here.
Absolutely. I think that the majority of these cases, there's a lot of clinical evidence. It's just the picture's not right. Something doesn't resonate right. And so the clinical presentation and the history is so essential in these cases. And I would say that just every time I've seen something like, something's just been off. And it is a complete picture that you put together with all of these modalities, your sort of history, the clinical exam, imaging, and ultimately biopsy. So they have looked at sort of those markers that they can use for kind of pulmonary fungal diseases. And the answer is we have no idea how, it's just too early. It hasn't been looked at for fungal stuff. And so I would not bother ordering those because I don't know how to interpret them.
What about just labs that kind of evaluate their like immune system? Like, you know,
yeah,
would you want to look at like your ANC, like their hemoglobin A1C or their, you know, like stuff like that?
So that's fair. So there's no labs that are going to diagnose, oh, positive fungus here, other than tissue biopsy with culture and seeing the fungal elements. However, you can evaluate their metabolic state and BMP and or CMP. You want to see if they're acidotic. And if they're in a DKA, that's a huge piece of evidence. The hemoglobin A1C to get an idea of what their sugar control has been like over what the 3-month period. All of those are really important just to kind of paint a fuller picture. And again, I think I've seen this develop in folks whose hemoglobin A1C was like 7 point something. So it doesn't have to be horrendous. I don't think 7 point something is great, but you know, it's not right. 11 or 14 or
yeah, I've seen worse. Yeah.
And then as far as kind of the classic other immune signs for chronic, I mean, if a person does, and there was one study where patients had developed sort of chronic invasives in the setting of hematologic malignancy. So it is possible. And I think that they actually found that an ANC level of greater than 1,000 was associated with improved survival. And so I think that the ANC is something I'm mostly going to be looking at in an individual who is on like chemotherapy or has a hematologic malignancy. And insofar as you can correct that and follow it, then yes, that could be really really helpful.
So Ashley, what's on our differential here? So I know we've discussed tumor. We want to get biopsy. Usually we think path and biopsy. We're thinking tumor. Do inverted papillomas have a similar presentation? What else is in your box of 3 to 4 things that may have something similar to some of these findings?
So like you said, malignancy, typically not just your run-of-the-mill sinus disease. Inverted papilloma would not be something I would expect, because unless it had converted to a cancer, because then you can very easily see a lot of infiltrative changes then into the tissue. So, but again, that kind of comes back to malignancy. I would say that it's kind of some other zebras. So vasculitis, pseudotumor, some kind of autoimmune process, those are going to be on my differential as well. IgG4 disease. You know, I think those are the main ones, just because this is so unusual.
All basically requiring some tissue pathology to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, and a multidisciplinary care team, an approach to sort of evaluating everything and kind of talking to your colleagues to see, hey, is there something that I'm missing? What do you recommend here?
So for the patient who's in the hospital, what's your kind of order of operations? How quickly do you need to go to the operating room to get path? Is there anything that you do in the meantime while you're waiting as far as like starting medications?
It depends kind of how they present. Now, if they've gone blind or are sort of losing vision, I think you need to act on things immediately. And if they are started on antifungals before I get them to the operating room, that's okay by me, because preserving their functionality is goal number one, right? And then getting the diagnosis to sort of help support that is also a priority, but you need to do what you need to do to keep the patient as whole and well as possible. So I feel like a lot of times we are not the front line. These aren't the people that they're not immediately coming to us. So there's been some stuff that's been done and you're just sort of walking into this situation and maybe a little bit later on the scene than some other folks, or infectious disease has been consulted and they're like, you need to get ENT involved. So yeah, we arrive at some point. And I always see my role in this as being the person that goes and procures tissue and sends that for the appropriate testing.
For tissue, this might sound like a silly question, but do you need a lot? Or because, you know, when I think of sinonasal biopsies, the lesion is very vascular. It's like, get what you can and get out and pack. This, it doesn't sound like it would be too bloody. So you could probably get what you need to. But how much tissue do you like to get? Because I feel like just a little Blakesley size, you're going to end up with, we don't have enough specimen or something. Does that ever pop in your head when you do these? Like, I don't know. There's always, mm-hmm. I'm always like, Do I have enough?
Oh gosh, yes. I've been in the situation more than once where they're looking and they can't find fungal elements. And for that chronic invasive, and I think that, you know, our chairman, who is a rhinologist, has also said that he's had cases where like you just could not get pinned down fungus. So I send a lot, any area that I can. And in cases where they're pterygopalatine fossa or the orbital apex, I try to get to those areas and get samples because disease is present and it shouldn't be there. And so I do chase these things a little bit, not to the extent that like if they're not blind, I'm not going to go in there and blind them for the sake of like, but I am going to get a little bit into the orbit and I'm going to sample some of the orbital fat in a safe place. So I do try to send as much as I can. And you, of course, always want to make sure that you send the tissue for culture. I can't emphasize that enough. This is sort of an interesting area where sending it for some of the like mRNA analysis, so the 16S mRNA, would probably be a great idea. And the reason that I say that is because it can detect it at such a smaller level, but it also can get the answer back to you, I think, more quickly than routine standard cultures can. So if you have that feasibility, this might be the case where you want to submit tissue for that sort of testing.
Are you doing frozens as well?
I have. And when I've done it, it's usually been on the second go around because I'm wanting them to tell me that I've sampled something that can give them a diagnosis. But as we know, in cases that are not fulminant acute invasive, it can be really hard to detect fungus in frozen section. So I don't always kind of rely on that. But I think the second time around, usually I am, because I just want to know, did I get something? Please tell me there's something here so that I don't need to keep sending more, right?
Yeah. But otherwise, you're sending tissue for path and then fungal
for
culture.
Permanent. Mm-hmm. Right. Because, I mean, ultimately, they need to be able to run like the GMS stains on it to really do a thorough job. It's going to take the special staining. That's what we're really relying on. If they can give me a preliminary, there's fungus here, so that if we haven't started antifungals, we can start the person on antifungals, then that's really helpful. And so if I need to make decisions based off of that, then maybe I will send a frozen. It's a case-by-case situation.
In terms of empiric antifungals, when I think of acute invasive fungal sinusitis, the empiric is amphotericin. For chronic invasive fungal sinusitis, is the empiric antifungal also amphotericin, or is this a voriconazole type? You know, how, what do we usually start patients on?
Typically, it's ampho, and then they kind of back off depending on speciation.
And in chronic invasive, are we thinking Mucor, and, you know, the range from Mucor to Aspergillus to, I've even seen, you know, just Dermatocacias in acute invasive fungal sinusitis. So is it the whole gambit as well in chronic invasive?
It's the whole gambit. Yeah. I think the majority of cases end up being Aspergillus. Honestly, I think that's kind of the most common, but I've seen it due to Dermatocacias as well. Mucor, I'm a little bit less certain about. I remember because I had another case here within the last year. I was corresponding kind of with our IED doctors, and I found a paper, and I think everything was represented in this series. So,
so for the patient who, for that AFS patient, where they don't have any sort of neuropathy, they haven't, they're not losing their vision, but maybe there's just some funny looking spots on the MRI or the CT where you're like I'm a little bit concerned about this. Do you treat them different in the, as far as pre-op medications go? So I think the patient that we had shared, instead of doing steroids, you had recommended an antibiotic. I don't remember exactly what, but that was,
or maybe,
you know,
an
part
antifungal.
Of the kind of, I don't remember. Do you?
Itraconazole maybe?
How do you think? I thought you gave them doxycycline.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Well, yes. Okay. That would have been the case. Yes. To kind of reduce inflammation. Yeah. So I've really backed away from doing high dose steroids in AFS patients prior to surgery. I think that's what you're talking about. And the reason is because even though it's really rare, that conversion from just allergic fungal to invasive has been reported, and has been reported in individuals on high dose steroids. So I really don't do that anymore at all. Like pre-op, treat them with steroids. There's been a few people, this is interesting, but this is a little bit like out there. This is not evidence-based, but we have had a few individuals who had really bad AFS and for whatever reason could not get surgery right away. One individual actually was like diagnosed with a renal mass. So we were kind of like, we know your symptoms are really bothering you, but you need to kind of have this figured out first. So in the meantime, what we did, and I got this from Dr. Ryan, was treated them with steroids and itraconazole at the same time for kind of a prolonged course of the itraconazole and like a shorter course of the steroids. And anecdotally, I had a young woman with AFS who actually first presented with bronchopulmonary aspergillosis. And so she had been treated with like steroids and I think voriconazole or one of the azoles for like a really long period of time. And they had had initial imaging of her sinuses, I think like just when she had started the treatment. And then we had gotten repeat imaging and it was remarkably better. It wasn't 100% clear. And you cannot clear this up with just sort of medical treatment. It's a surgical disease process. And I actually took her to the operating room and there was still some fungal mucin in there, but it can sort of improve symptoms for people. But that's always dicey. You have to balance that. Obviously, both steroids and antifungals have a lot of side effects and the antifungals can be damaging to other organs. So that's not something that I like to kind of pull out and use other than very specific cases. But that has been something we've offered as a non-operative option for some individuals for a short period of time. So if you really want to do something to help cut down inflammation, there's not data to really support this, but you could use like a doxycycline and, you know, it does exert some sort of anti-inflammatory effects. But generally, I don't find that AFS cases bleed a whole bunch. They might at first, but once you start sort of getting in there and getting some of that fungal mucin out of there, unless they're acutely infected on top of the AFS, I just don't find that they really bleed that much. So I don't think it's necessary to do steroids, perhaps.
So even just that 2-week, 10-day or 14-day course of steroids, it might could be enough to kind of tip someone into chronic invasive.
You just never know. And the more I've sort of heard of and seen cases of it converting, I've just been like, I can't do this to people. And it's kind of like, I guess you have to ask yourself why you would do that, right? Are you doing it so that the surgery is a little bit easier for you? You know, is it really? So, I mean, not to say like that's a, but like, if that's my only reason is to kind of make the surgery a little bit easier or maybe safer or something, I can't sort of do that in the face of like possibly causing them to convert. And I think with AFS cases, look, if it's really, really hard and you are struggling, staging it is a complete and perfect option. Back out, go back in later. Take some time, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So for patients, let's say you have made the diagnosis, you got tissue confirmation, you have fungus that is invasive within the tissue, and you say, okay, this is a chronic invasive fungal sinusitis. What do the next several months look like for that patient? You know, as far as like how long do they need to be on antifungals and what's their surveillance like with you?
And also, do you have to go and do like a FESS? Like, is there any role of doing opening things up for irrigations or topicals or anything like that after the biopsy?
Yeah, I think I'll start with that, Gopi, because that's an important discussion point with chronic granulomatous and chronic invasive is how aggressive surgically do you get? And I think that we're at this interesting time where in the past, people used to advocate for very aggressive surgical resection of all involved tissue. I've never done that. And I don't think that that really maybe needs to play a part anymore in the management of these patients. I think that way of thinking and that management was born out of necessity back when amphotericin was non-liposomal and it would cause kidney failure. I mean, it was just people couldn't be on it for more than a few days at a time because their organs would start failing. So it was a really self-limited option. So now that we have the liposomal amphotericin and it no longer causes immediate organ failure or in like a really rapid time period, we've got a lot more time. And I'd say that even more importantly, the azole, then the development of those has led to improved medical management of these patients, which has reduced the necessity of being surgically aggressive. And, you know, in these cases, because of where they tend to go, so orbital apex, orbit, sphenoid, surgical resection, tegropalatine fossa, surgical resection would be quite morbid and potentially fatal. You're really in a tough spot there. So we definitely take a more measured surgical approach. I don't think it ever hurts to kind of open things up. If this isn't concurrent with like fungal ball or allergic fungal sinusitis, then I'm going to open those sinuses up to remove all of the fungal debris that's sitting there on the surface, right? And if there's anything by chance that is necrotic or you're concerned about viability, you could always kind of debride that as well. But mostly you're going in there just to get a diagnosis, in my opinion. Some people might disagree. And I think some people still go after that really aggressively, but that's just not something that we do here. So then it's all about getting the specimen, knowing the speciation, knowing what it is, and putting them on appropriate antifungals. And then the surveillance is imaging based. So you're looking to see if this stuff clears up. And in my experience, people have been on antifungals typically until maybe a little bit after the imaging sort of resolves. And if the imaging never resolves, so long as they're not getting worse, that makes you think that maybe there's something else going on that you need to go back in there. Maybe it's a different fungus that's not being sort of controlled by their current oral antifungal medication. Sometimes, like that person I started off talking about, that woman who went intracranial, they're going to be on it for the rest of their lives.
So for that patient, do they just have like a PICC line or a port and they're doing IV infusion every day?
No, that's the beautiful thing about the azoles is that they're all oral. So like voriconazole, itraconazole, posaconazole, all oral.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So they're on amphotericin until it speciates.
Exactly.
And then you can convert to oral. Okay.
Exactly. Yes. It's just like broad spectrum antibiotics until you get the, you know, you can kind of narrow it down.
What's that time frame look like?
months and months and months.
How long do you think does it usually take to get that speciation and get them transitioned?
Oh, that could take about a week or so. And you know, what I've been finding is that a lot of times they will kind of transition them off the ampho quickly. So they might be on that for like 3 to 5 days or something. And maybe even before they have the speciation, with maybe some of the earlier information, they can start to kind of put them on. I think posaconazole has been kind of a popular option. So they might go ahead and do that. It probably depends on the infectious disease doctor.
Yeah.
And sort of what's going on with the patient overall, as far as like renal function, all that.
Just going back to the initial presentation, it sounds like this is usually a unilateral presentation or?
I have not seen it bilateral, fortunately. And I'm not aware of any reports of it being bilateral.
So after they're discharged, when do you see them back? And when do you order that first surveillance imaging?
So I'll usually see them at about a week just to kind of check in. And mostly that's sort of like a, hey, let's make sure that you've got your other follow-ups and that you're on your medications and that you understand that you're going to need to be on these. And then typically the repeat imaging is up to ID. And I kind of let them decide that. I probably wouldn't get it earlier than 1 month and would maybe go about 3 months, 12 weeks, 6 to 12 weeks of treatment before doing that, and then kind of go from there. So it's a conversation with UNID.
And that's an MRI usually?
Typically, yeah.
Or sort of the three main things as opposed to any of the sinonasal symptoms that they probably didn't have to begin with for this.
Correct. Right. It's like the absence of sort of sinonasal symptoms. And I think in a few series of patients, like everybody presented with headache or facial pain.
Do those symptoms respond pretty quickly?
They do, actually. Yeah. So the woman that I had mentioned who had the severe facial pain for a year prior to presentation, her pain rapidly got better, which was very rewarding. And she was grateful.
Awesome. Well, I mean, this has been a really informative, really great talk. As we round things out, anything that we've missed or anything we need to make sure that we touch on before we let you go?
No, I mean, I think it's worth just sort of repeating the fact that the question of how aggressive surgically do you need to be is very up in the air right now. And I can speak from experience when I say I've not regretted not being more surgically aggressive. I would say that in the majority of patients that I have treated, we've done limited debridement just to get the diagnosis and then really relied on the better antifungals that we have now and in a very prolonged course of treatment, but we've not kind of disfigured anybody unnecessarily or blinded them or removed an eye or anything like that, and they've survived. So I would say if you're faced with one of these cases, don't swing for the fences necessarily. And I think that that's something that we as a field need to really revisit is the necessity of aggressive surgical treatment in these patients with the new age of antifungals.
Well, thank you so much, Ashley. If any of our audience wants to reach out to you, are you on any social media? And if you're not, they can reach out to us on Backtable. We can relay the message.
I don't have any social media, but I would be happy to, if you guys want to relay it to me, please feel free to contact the podcast with questions and I would be happy to correspond. So
awesome. Thanks for taking the time,
Ashley. Thank you, Ashley.
This is great.
Thanks for having me again. It's really good to see you, girls.
So great to see you.
Too.
All right.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at @BacktableENT on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter. Backtable ENT is hosted by Gopi Shaw
and Ashley Agan.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz, with support from
Taylor Spurgeon Hess,
social media and PR by Chi Ding,
administrative support provided by Jamila Kennebrew.
Thanks again for listening and see you next week.